Josh and Frankie.
What a couple of dumb shits.
Hello, primates. You found Primus Tracks. Congratulations. We're at Primus Tracks on Instagram and Twitter and that other thing. PrimusTracksPod at gmail.com is the email address. And of course, I'm joined by my pal, Frankie.
Hi, Josh.
Well, this is an interesting one today, Frankie. It's like we're delving into the roots underground, things that make Primus Primus.
It's going to be a fun one for sure. We have a really amazing guest joining us today.
Yes, we do. We should bring him in. As I said, this is like the first in a series. We're going to talk to a Talking Heads expert. He's going to help us with the influence that the Talking Heads and David Byrne exerted over the men of Primus. And we're going to find some similar threads in their sounds, I suppose. He has a Talking Heads podcast. It's called This Must Be Talking Heads. You can also find him on Instagram at This Must Be Talking Heads. It was very nice of him to do that because it's much easier to remember. Rodney Gordon, welcome to Primus Tracks.
Hello, guys. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me on. It's a real pleasure.
Oh, man. And you sound great.
That's what I'm going for. Am I the first Australian voice on the show?
Indeed.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. So it's really good that you can project your voice that far. Very important.
Now, a bit of practice.
I do want to say, you have an actual podcast. And what's that like?
Oh, boy, it's a slog. I do a lot of production. It's the hardest thing I've probably ever worked on. And sometimes, you know, episodes might take 3, 4, 5 months to pull together. And I get a lot of messages and emails saying, love the show. When are you going to do any more? I wish I had a bit more time to put into it. I also do another podcast and I work a full-time job and I have a family. So I'm a pretty busy guy.
Yeah.
But I drink a lot of coffee and that helps.
Well, I got to say, with the quality of your podcast, you are someone for us to emulate. But don't be surprised if, we might just kidnap you and beat the secrets out of you instead.
Well, boy, well, I guess I have no say either way on that.
And it comes after the show. We wouldn't broadcast that. That'd be rude. So
I'll just drink this tea that you guys brought me. Thank you so much.
Yes. Sit back and relax. Close your eyes now. Okay, so we're talking about the Talking Heads today. And I will say right out of the bat, I am a Talking Heads neophyte newbie. I know nothing about them. Frankie has pretty extensive experience with the music and the personalities. And Rodney, obviously, with a podcast called This Must Be Talking Heads, I think you might know a thing or two. So you guys, take it away. Help us understand how Talking Heads was such a huge influence on Primus and Les Claypool in those early years.
So feel free if you want to guide me to any particular areas. But I mean, I obviously know that the Talking Heads were an impact and one of the early influences on Primus. You could say that they were maybe one of the bands that they picked up on early as someone they wanted to emulate, not entirely, but certain elements really spoke to them. And I think that that's really key to understanding the influence.
Okay.
And at first glance, based on what people know of Talking Heads and based on what people know of Primus, they might seem like strange bedfellows at first, but our job today will be to demystify that and get into some of the details. And you can certainly hear in the early Primus stuff, the live recordings in the very early days, you can definitely hear a clear Talking Heads influence and some other bands. When you have a finely tuned ear and you've heard enough Talking Heads the way I have and probably Frankie has, you can definitely hear the elements that they were keying in on. It's interesting, I think, that those elements develop as they progress through their albums and develop their own following, doing their own thing, what they keep, what they adapt, and what they abandon. But we can start from the very start. I think Talking Heads is a really good one to do from the start for you guys, because there'll be other influences later that definitely shape their sound as their trajectory changes over the years.
Yeah, that's a great point. I was thinking maybe we started too obscure, but no, I think you're right. starting with one that's less obvious for somebody listening to Pork Soda as opposed to listening to those early Primus demos where, I mean, they really cherry-picked a lot from some of the Talking Heads sound and put it on top of their own little salad there. So what is it that you're hearing in some of those earlier tracks that translate from Talking Heads?
In particular, for me, and this might be more Todd Huth's influence, but it's definitely the sort of muted guitar, the chucking, the scratching that is added in. It adds a bit of speed and it adds a lot of texturing and a lot of atmosphere. And, you know, there's the especially those first two or three Talking Heads albums, they really lean on that a lot. And it really comes to the fore on an album like Remaining Light, where there's lots of layering and things have progressed so far from just guitar, bass, drums, maybe keyboard into like, well, now we've got 24 layers and there's five guitar layers and there's three bass lines and things like that all interweave and overlap. in the sort of polyrhythmic way that they were exploring at the time. I think there's definitely in the early Primus sound a lot of just chucking to kind of keep the groove going. You can hear that in songs from the Talking Heads repertoire, from like the Fear of Music album has a song called Cities. You can listen to the album version or especially a live version. You'll hear a lot of chucking. And I can hear that in the sort of Is It Luck demos and the early live versions of that song. I think it's interesting that that sort of has come to typify the Talking Heads sound and the influence they had on lots of other bands ever since then. All the bands now that are sort of indie bands or all the bands from the last 15 years that you've heard of, LCD Sound System or Franz Ferdinand or whoever, when they say they have that Talking Heads influence, it's usually what they're going for is that guitar, that angular guitar notes and angular chord and unusual chords combined with some chucking to just keep the rhythm going. Okay. They obviously take that from sort of soul and R&B and funk, in particular funk. Okay. But there's a, like, for example, there's a song on the Talking Heads concert film called Found a Job. And if you're familiar with Stop Making Sense, it starts with David Byrne, then the bass player comes on, then the drummer comes on, and then Jerry Harrison comes on. And Jerry Harrison comes on, and his song, he just walks out with his guitar, and he just starts chucking, chuck, 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 chuck. And until the chorus, that's all he does. And through all the verses, that's all he does is just chuck, 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 chuck. So you can see how important it is to the Talking Heads sound that it just adds that textural layer. So when I listen to the early Primus stuff and I hear that chuck, 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 I'm like, ah, I see what you were doing there.
Yes, Rodney, I agree completely with your description. In fact, I remember David Byrne himself in an interview describing the sound of the Talking Heads as herky-jerky. That was his own term. Yes. And I recall a VIP I was present at for Primus where Les Claypool said, you know, Primate sounded nothing like Primus. He said it was kind of a Talking Heads sound. So when we compare both things, Is It Luck in particular, I think it definitely has a Talking Heads quality to it. Josh, could you please play a portion of that song to exemplify what we're describing?
There it is. I would say, based on the little bit I know about Talking Heads, yeah, it's just the guitar. The rest of it is coming from somewhere else.
Oh, for sure.
So, I mean, Rodney, if I put that up against Found a Job, is that what you'd say? You would say we would find something similar there?
I reckon if you can find a live version, there's a live album called... you can probably get the Stop Making Sense. Right? That one would be fine, yeah.
Rodney, it also echoes a little bit of Cities, right? Like you mentioned.
Yeah. So Cities is another interesting one where I got to interview Jerry Harrison last year, and I was asking him about guitar effects, the use of echo and delay pedals. And in particular, I was like, hey, you know, you guys toured with U2 and they went pretty far down that road, you know. And Jerry Harrison was like, hey, you know, I want to take credit for that. let me think. We have a song. Yeah, I know. We have a song called Cities where we use lots of delays. That's probably where The Edge got all of his influence from. They like to claim every bit of influence they can. But I think that they have pretty strong credentials for doing that sometimes.
Let's try this one. It says Cities Live 1983.
No one can see this call that we're on, but we're all sitting here nodding our head in exactly the same way for both of those tracks. So, I mean, you know, you go and see Primate or Primus live and you're probably starting a pit and you're probably getting a little bit more heavy into it. But, I mean, one of the success that Talking Heads found early was this combination of hitting people right in the guts, right in the head and right in the groin, getting them to think and dance and move at the same time.
That's the first time I've heard the first 37 seconds of Cities in my life. But I already hear it.
You have homework to do.
I think one of the ancillary benefits of coming on here is you're going to turn me into a Talking Heads fan. And I'm going to go out and get all their records and then listen to a podcast about them. So
that's perfect.
Frankie's been trying for years, but Rodney, you're the key here.
I'm now his wingman in that mission, for sure. I think there's obviously the guitar is going to be the biggest influence in the early Primus years, but there's elements of just doing something prominent and interesting with the bass lines. for sure, Tina Weymouth does one particular thing with her bass lines, and Les Claypool does something very, 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 very different with his bass lines. They're both, I think, tremendous. They're both incredibly creative, but they're just trying to do different things. But just the prominence of them in the presence of the band as a whole, the fact that someone would go and see them play live and go, holy crap, that bass player was amazing for both bands. I think that that's also something that probably attracted them. I know that Les was probably interested in any band where you would watch them and go, yeah, the bass player was just as prominent as the guitarist or the drummer. And then there was sort of a bit more of a democracy across the stage, not just, I love watching Eddie Van Halen sing and play guitar. Like, I mean, I think that that's the vibe he was going for with his bands. And the thing that he wanted to project was everybody gets a go. Everybody's doing something interesting. We might suck, but at least we're interesting, right?
Well, you said the magic word suck, and we know that that was a key term.
I'm a Primus fan. That's my credentials proven.
As they were on their way. I do want to play a portion of a very early version of Too Many Puppies, Rodney, and I want to hear your thoughts on this one. I definitely hear the connection with the guitar, but you mentioned the interesting bass line, and anybody who knows their Primus knows that Too Many Puppies bass line, but here it is in double, triple, quadruple time. I don't know. It's very fast. But I wonder if you hear any other threads that might lead back to Talking Heads from this version of around 1987.
Too many puppies are being shot in the dark. Too many puppies are trading too far. Get the size of blood that must be spilled so that we may
So are you hearing anything in the bass or vocals there?
I mean, there's obviously the sort of heavier chord progression through the chorus. During the verse, it's a little bit more sort of almost bouncy, pulsing, you might say. I think there's a really iconic bass line for something like Psycho Killer on the Studio album, which is almost like mimicking someone's heartbeat. And I feel like it's slightly elevated. It sounds a little bit like a heartbeat to me, at least. So I think there's an immediate comparison to be made there. There's probably other examples that you could think of, but that
the
one
stop
from
start quality, right? It's also something that the Talking Heads used in the beginning.
It's one thing that Talking Heads learned quite early, and they worked with a lot of really clever live sound engineers, was about leaving space in their mix so that you can pick out different elements. It doesn't sound too washed out. Nothing just sort of competes with anything else. If you leave a space in the middle, then that's where the vocals will really shine. And I think leaving notes, leaving little gaps, lets you pick out other elements in what else is going on as well. If you're looking for comparisons to draw back to Talking Heads, the first one that comes to mind is Psycho Killer. There might be equally others where there's plotting, stop-start, little bass lines, but bass notes. But I think, like someone said to me the other day, when they listened to, we're going to talk about Stop Making Sense, we're going to say that a lot. A lot of people probably are familiar, peripherally at least, with that from Talking Heads. But listening to the live version from Stop Making Sense, where it's just David playing guitar with a boombox playing a drum beat, you don't get that plodding bass line. And I think a lot of people have said, look, if that was there, that might be a better version. But the studio version just has that extra element. And it's interesting that that's there for the verse of that version. It's through the studio version too, right, for that song, for Puppies. I think it's there in the studio version. It's not too different than that live version.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it's just picking up on that element of like through the verse, we're just going to bump, 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 and then we're going to elevate.
I also think, Rodney, there could be a parallel between the vocals in the sense that Les Claypool said in multiple occasions that he did not consider himself a singer. He thought of himself as a narrator, to like a vehicle to carry the lyrics in the songs. And I have also heard David Byrne refer to himself as not exactly a singer. I mean, I recall an interview where he said that at one point he thought, well, maybe I do need singing lessons. And he said that the teacher tried to get him to practice with sending the clowns, and he dropped the lessons completely. He realized now that that his voice is a resource for him. So he's not someone that considers himself a singer in the strict sense of the word.
That's a really good point. I hadn't thought of that necessarily, but definitely in the early days of Talking Heads, the first few albums, and when they were really forming, like in that sort of seminal CBGB scene, they were definitely trying to step away from everything that was accepted. So they didn't dress the way that you thought, an indie rock band should dress. They didn't write songs about what you were supposed to write songs about. They also didn't sound the way other bands were sounding. So there was no flashy guitar solos. It was all in service of an idea. But one of the elements was whatever you expect, we are going to try and deliver something different. I guess Primus probably does that too. Definitely with the singing, David Byrne reaches a point where he tries to leave behind the early years of angular guitars. I mean, at one point, I think in his book, How Music Works, he writes, you know, I was doing angular guitar shit while the drummer was doing nice solid basses, and that was a good, interesting mix. And it's definitely true with the vocals. In the early albums, it's lots of screeching, squeaking, popping, especially in the live versions. And then there's a real change in the early 80s, I would say, probably around 1980, from talking, singing, singing that's only like five steps better than what I could probably do, to really getting on his game. Those vocal lessons and those singing lessons definitely start to take prominence. I think at the time he said something like, I was trying to get singing lessons so that I could protect my voice. We were doing so much recording, so much touring. I needed to look after my voice. But other people have said, no, he wanted to be a crooner. He wanted to lean into that mic and croon away without so much strange sounds. So he wanted to move away from that weird sound and get towards something a little bit. And also demonstrate some range. That's one of his favorite things to do, David Byrne. But I think Les does that a little bit as well, right? And he goes from being a lanky, skinny guy on stage to sort of squealing to someone who really wants to be able to carry a bit of a tune.
Yeah, that's been the thread over the years, is that he's turned more into a singer and explored it, you know, more than a storyteller. So it's really cool to see that development in others as well, like in his influences. But I was curious about that too, because in that early recording, I just hear that too many pop, you know, just that nervy too many puppies vocal delivery. Once again, I don't know David Byrne that well, but I know he's a weirdo. I'm like, that guy sounds like a weirdo too. So it just seems like there's really I think they're pulling more than I thought for those first efforts, considering Puppies was the first Primus song.
I think that you mean David Byrne is a weirdo to be a compliment. So I'm gonna take it that way.
Oh, yes, absolutely. That is not
in that way that we're all great weirdos.
I would never use that in a negative way, ever. I'm looking at the Talking Heads discography, and you know, right around the time that these Primus dudes are coming of age, as far as like young adult teenage years, I'm seeing really those first four records, 77 through 80. I mean, where do you hear the influence most as far as a guy like me who doesn't know these records? Would I start with something like Remain in Light or Fear of Music?
I don't think you can go wrong if you start with Remain in Light. I think a song like Cross-Eyed and Painless, a nice long-ish kind of jam song, definitely live, it became a bit of a jam thing, which is another element that Primus pick up later on as well, which is interesting. But the guitar solos and the guitar influence of Adrian Belew, mm-hmm. the sort of crazy element that brings, I'm sure is part of what probably hooked someone like Les and the other members of Primus as well to say, yeah, we want to be a crazy band where things zigzag around the stage all the time. And you never know what you're going to stand there and see. You don't know what we're going to put out for you to pick up. I think that era of 1980-81 where Adrian Belew was recording crazy guitar solos and adding lines to the songs on Remain in Light. Plus he joins the touring band after that. So does mm-hmm. half the country. It's a huge touring band after that for Talking Heads, but the Adrian Belew era would definitely be something that I think a lot of people who probably are interested in bands like Primus, interested in bands that explore polyrhythms, interested in bands that just do interesting stuff. That 1980-81 era, you know, there's the Remaining Light album, but there's lots of live shows. There's a great Talking Heads live album called The Name of This Band is Talking Heads that has lots of songs from that era as well. Like a whole, it's a double LP, but one LP is dedicated to that whole era. So that would be a really good place to start, I think, for anyone looking for a foothold.
I'm glad you mentioned those, and I'm glad you mentioned Adrian, because when the Primus guys run down their influences, they invariably say David Bowie, Frank Zappa, King Crimson, Talking Heads, and there's one guy,
Adrian Belew,
yes, who got to record and tour with all four of those all-time acts.
I don't know if you know it, but there's a great story that Adrian Belew talks about where he leaves Frank Zappa's band and joins David Bowie's band, where Adrian's talking to Bowie and he says, look, I'm contracted to tour with Zappa for a little bit longer. And David Bowie says, we'll take care of it. Don't worry. So he makes a call. They sort it out. And he's like, let's go and celebrate. So David Bowie, he takes him out for dinner. They go out to a club. They have some drinks. They walk into the club. And who's sitting there but Frank Zappa? And Adrian Belew was like, fuck, I've just stabbed this guy in the back. And David Bowie walks over. He's like, hello, Frank. I'm sure you know what's going on. And I hope we can deal with this like gentleman. And
Frank Zappa says,
he says, fuck you, Captain Tom. It's not only does he abuse David Bowie, but he demotes him from Major Tom to Captain Tom. A great move. Man.
I can imagine.
They got on well after that, and it was all forgiven within a few minutes.
Oh, good. I would hate to be in the middle of that.
We've also seen everyone knows, though, as well. Obviously, I'm a big Lur fan as well. So, like any guitarist of his caliber, he has a huge pedal board full of effects and all kinds of crazy things. And I'm sure that he stole moves from Adrian Belew, and he'd probably admit that influenced hugely. But Adrian Belew was kind of known as the guy who would get an effects pedal that had three different knobs. So it would be like effect one, effect two, effect three. And he'd be like, what if I put the knob right in between effect one and two and get both of them, like hack the knob so I get both effects at the same time.
Yeah.
And he's like, everyone's going, how are you getting that sound? He's like, I can't tell you. Except then the next version of that pedal that they make that a feature so that you can snip it right in between those two effects. And they stole the Adrian Belew effect and built it into their devices. But it's that degree of experimentation and just hours and hours and hours sitting at home mucking around with your equipment so that you can then walk into the studio and people hit record and say, play us a solo, and you blow their minds. Like, you just start playing and it's like magic is coming out of your fingers. So it takes days and days of work to achieve that kind of thing. But Adrian Belew just walking in and just completely changing the game, especially for Talking Heads, would have been something that really excited people who were watching those cool up-and-coming bands like Talking Heads. And then going, I want to do what he did. I want to have that influence that guy had.
In the Primus world, we know that Belew has performed on stage with them. We know that Les has recorded with Adrian for a couple of his releases. Where would I hear some of that vintage Adrian Belew on some of these Heads records?
Definitely want to look to if you want the good stuff, you want to look on Remaining Light. Two tracks: the Great Curve and Cross Eyed and Painless would be the two I would go to.
Okay.
But there's other songs on that album that are obscure little gems, like Listening Wind, where he comes in and you're not getting the sort of fast, manic, all over the place, crazy guitar sounds, but you're getting him making sounds like guitars have never made sounds before, little bird sounds and tweaking sounds. And it's, if you were listening to it, you wouldn't even know what it was. And then you find out later, oh, that's Adrian Belew. That's Adrian Belew just playing guitar, doing very, very, very strange stuff.
Yes, that's true. Particularly for me, you know, first time that I heard Remaining Light, I kept going back on the guitar solo of Born Under Punches because I couldn't believe it. I had never heard anything like that before. It's so unique and it's so amazing.
And apparently they just brought him in and they said, here's the track, hit record. He started playing and people were in the control room, jumping up and down. He could see them through the glass and he was like, I guess what I'm doing is pretty good. And this is after a few, I would say, mixed success of bringing in another guitar influence. It works well on some of the other songs, but some other songs, there's alternate versions where it's like, here's one where Robert Fripp plays guitar and you listen to it and you're like, I can understand why you kept that in the drawer. Nothing against Robert Fripp, but Adrian Belew he just brings the magic. And I can definitely understand why he would get people really excited. Yeah, Born Under Punches is another really good one.
Oh.
It sounds like we're just celebrating Remaining Light, but I mean, there's a reason why this album is it's a bit of an undiscovered gem. At the time, it didn't really make too much of a splash, but just over the years, it has just grown and grown and grown in influence and credibility, and it keeps going up. Every 5 years, Rolling Stone will release their top 100 albums, and it just keeps going up. So it's one that people are really recognizing the influence of over time as well.
Okay.
And if I'm not mistaken, Rodney, it was also the album where the tension began, right?
Yes, you're 100% right. And I mean, it's there's a good reason why Brian Eno was not invited back to produce their albums anymore.
Oh, I was curious about that because I saw him as the producer on it. And I was like, there's a big hitter.
He's listed as producer. If he had his way, his name would be right on the front cover, right next to the band name. And I mean, he did a lot on that album and he contributed quite a lot to the songwriting and just really elevating things. But I mean, you either join the band or you don't. And he didn't want to join the band. He just wanted to take the songwriting credit, which I don't think would have sat very – I know it didn't sit well with some of the band members. So they went off and toured, and then next time they recorded, he was not welcome.
Well, I had one follow-up because I did look at the credits for Remain in Light. I believe it was Remain in Light. And I saw Robert Palmer on there on percussion, the same Robert Palmer.
Yes. So they recorded that album at Compass Point Studios in the Bahamas. Robert Palmer lived – there. They had a house there. So did Chris and Tina from the band. And he happened to be hanging out And they were like, hey, why don't you play on one of these songs? Just add a little, it was like, he hits a little percussion drum thing. He just hits it. I mean, at first you might think, Robert Palmer, that's a strange one. You sort of know him as the guy in the suit singing Simply Irresistible. But if you go beyond that into his musical repertoire, it's very, very interesting. But he also does a song on his album, which is called Looking for Clues, with the, you know, a great single called Looking for Clues. And it turns out that his drummer had recorded a bass drum line to go in that song that was apparently fine, but just too much. It was too busy. And Chris France from Talking Heads went in and recorded on Robert Palmer's song. And he just does a straight four on the floor bass drum line. And that's exactly what the song needed. So they did return the favor there.
Yeah, I'm amazed to know that that's that Robert Palmer.
Yeah, that's it's neat. That one. It's amazing.
I want to play one more Primus cut. This is from way back in 1986. And this is called They. It eventually became known as 11. I don't know if you've heard this one, but I want to see what you hear in this track.
Definitely hearing some more guitar similarities. I'm trying to think of songs where there's like a bit of chucking and then sliding up the fretboard, like meow. Uh-huh. Like there's probably a couple of those. Maybe something like Laughter in Wartime would have a bit of that. Even the vocals, when it came in, I was like, oh, this is sort of like a, I mean, I'd never noticed it with 11 before, but then hearing this early version, it just sounds so different with almost like a backing vocal, which becomes quite prominent for Talking Heads in the early 80s as well. The guitar, the sort of chucking and then a up the fretboard. Maybe something like, oh, Once in a Lifetime has a little, it's really low in the mix though, but you can hear it if you hear, especially the isolated guitars from Once in a Lifetime. You can really hear the zero up and down the fretboard.
It almost sounded like this track, it was too smooth to have too much of a Talking Heads vibe to it, as far as it being in that 11 time signature. So it's a pseudo waltz, but you know, you're talking about the just taking it back a little bit on the drums. Is that a common thing in the Talking Heads where they, because you talked about giving space, you know, and then I think about Tim Alexander, who can take up all the space by himself if he wants to.
Yes, sure.
But in the Talking Heads universe, is it more of a, you know, the drummer just kind of keeps it rolling and doesn't do too much to take up too much space?
Yeah, I think for most of the active Talking Heads years, the drumming from Chris France is a little bit underrated. It's definitely in service of the song. Some of it is, I mean, some would say this, and in a non-generous way, some might say it was a bit pedestrian, but I think it is really recognized as being the driving force of the band, the rhythm section. So the drums and bass, that's Chris France and Tina Weymouth, and they were actually married. They're a couple.
Okay.
So the duo of them, drum and bass, propelling the songs forward. Drums were always the first thing laid down, usually bass part second. And then weeks later, after David Byrne had gone through his sort of little moments and creative process of locking himself in a car and driving halfway across the country to work out guitar parts and write lyrics, he would come back and sort of finish the song off. That was how most of the albums were done, right?
Wow.
So they were quite fundamental. Any song that you could point to that's like a big hit that really took off, you could point to the drums and bass as being like what people experience sort of first. Like it talks to you on an instinctual level before all the layering and all the craziness, guitar solos, before all of that stuff really blows your mind.
I knew 11 or They reminded me of something, and I think I got it. Josh, can you play Right Start from Remain in Light?
Remain in Light again? Do these guys have any other records? All right.
So do you want to talk about what Right Start is, or do you want to hear it first?
Oh, I want to hear about it. Sure.
So Right Start resurfaced in around 2005 when Talking Heads went through all their albums and reissued them. So this was after they were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and there was a renewed interest in the band and their back catalog in particular, and they reissued all their albums with extra tracks. So Right Start wasn't on the original LP. It was an early track, and they sort of went through lots of, especially for Remain in Light, they would jam out songs. They would sort of, I mean, this is kind of interesting to me anyway, but Brian Eno told them, why don't you try, everybody go away and think of a part in a certain time signature, then don't tell anyone what it is or show anyone what it is. Come back together, get a little boom box and hit record and play for 30 seconds and just see what it is. It might work, it might not work, but you'll come up with something interesting. So that was how they started with a lot of their songs. They kind of did an improvised jam, then they picked the ones that they liked, picked the elements that they liked, and just built on them. So that was how a lot of the jams started of the songwriting process. Then they started to sort of finesse them and organize them into some kind of structure. So some core elements here, they're still fine-tuning things for sure, and there's still a lot of production that's going to go into this song. But this song will go on to become Once in a Lifetime. And I think one of the reasons it reminds you of that so much, Frankie, is because of that guitar slide. And it's really prominent in this version. So this is a good one to listen to.
Picking up on that, I can see Todd Huth playing something like this or hearing something like this and thinking, how can I take it even further afield?
That I can see it happening before my eyes, Josh. You're becoming like Talking Heads are now your second favorite band.
No comment, but yes. That sounds great. This is so interesting to me to be exposed to this band, first of all, in front of the ears of dozens, literally dozens of people, probably. But to hear it and to hear the DNA, the Primus DNA in there somewhere. I know we're going to cover these other bands, but this is the one I'm least familiar with. So it's kind of nice and different to be thrown in.
This song that we just heard just then wasn't around back in the 80s. But
right.
It shows that those elements were there, but they were kind of buried. And I think that really shows the detail and the way they were really mining into these songs, looking for what made them what they were and picking out those kind of elements. So it really shows that they were very forensic in their exploration of what the music they liked. They were really digging deep on it.
In terms of lyrical content, we know that Les loves using characters to drive his songs. He loves singing from the perspective of different characters, many of them tragic the majority of the time. And at the same time, we have David Byrne, who is a person that also uses those resources. He also makes a lot of social observation. And there are very, very few examples of David Byrne singing in first person about something related to his life. I think we can find some examples of that in the self-titled album from 94. There are some really, really deep, really personal songs on that album. I recall a song that obsessed me for a long time called A Self-Made Man. And I wondered why he played all that album live so much. But he used to skip that track a lot. There are very few examples of that song live. And I had the opportunity to meet him one time. And I asked him, how come you didn't do A Self-Made Man that often? And he told me that it was quite a personal song for him. So you can see that we're talking about a musician who shies away from singing about himself too much. He uses other resources to tell stories. And there's an interesting parallel here regarding love, because when it comes to Primus, we could argue whether Mary the Ice Cube is a love song or not. But personally, I believe the first true love song that Les ever wrote in his career was I Want Gal, which came very good over 20 years into his career. And it's not a conventional love song by any means. Mm-hmm. And in terms of David Byrne, there's a really fantastic article in The Quietus that quotes one of his phrases from the Stop Making Sense interview. And he says, I try to write about small things like paper, animals, or houses. Love is kind of big. And the article says, this obsession with the minutiae of human existence is a rejection of typical songwriting, one that David Byrne has persuaded for the majority of his long career. So I would say that a rejection of typical song subjects also applies pretty well for Primus. What do you guys think?
Not knowing any Talking Heads lyrics at this point in my life, other than Psycho okay. Killer, when I look through the list of Primus DNA, which we're eventually going to talk about all these bands, Residents, Zappa, King Crimson, Tom Waits, Jerry Reed, you know, Sly and the Family Stone. I mean, most of those, the lyrical content from most of those artists is way off the beaten path. about minutia or taboo or weird things? And I shouldn't say weird because I don't want to use it pejoratively, Rodney.
But sorry, I feel so bad now that I picked you up on that.
No, it's good. I'm I'm monitoring my vocabulary to say what I actually right. want to say. You know, these are all acts that take on topics that are beyond the norm, and I think that all seeped in to the lyric writing when it comes to Primus too.
Definitely agree, and it's a great point, Frankie. I think my perspective on the Talking Heads element of that is, the early years in particular, they sort of only write two kind of songs. One is from a particular point of view or a particular character. The other is just almost just sort of non sequiturs string together that sound good. So, I mean, they that sort of culminates on the Speaking in Tongues album, where you could point to three or four songs and it just sounds like a random collection of words. And I mean, it's almost like someone just cut up all the words and sort of pulled them out of a bag and lined them up. Now, obviously, I would probably argue there's a deeper thing going on there. It's not all random. It might seem random, but it never is with artists, right? But also on that album, you get the first proper love song, which is This Must Be the Place, brackets Naive Melody, which David admits is the first time he wrote a love song. It's probably one of the first times he wrote a genuine, earnest love song. And he's dealt with topics of relationships. He's dealt with topics of love, but it's usually like, this is a song that's about being hurt by somebody. And I'm not going to say a human hurt me. I'm going to say the air hurt me, or it's a piece of a relationship is like a piece of paper. So the song is about a piece of paper, but the subtext is love, relationships, and all that deep stuff. And then there's some early songs which are very explicitly about what we would call now, I guess, gender politics or gender identity or whatever you would want to call it. But it always flirts with that topic and then doesn't really commit in it. He always has a plausible deniability and a distance to say, no, that's just a song. I was just writing from a certain perspective. That's not what I think. But I think that's more a reflection of David Byrne being very careful and guarded about himself. Uh-huh. And he has obviously spoken over the years about his social anxiety, his difficulty relating to people in social interactions and social situations, and how that seems at odds with the idea of, well, you started a band, you get up and sing in a band on stage in front of, I guess in the early days at CBGBs, it was tens of people, but then hundreds and then thousands and then tens of thousands and then millions when you really break it big. That seems at odds with you saying you don't feel comfortable in front of people. But his point of view was always like, yeah, it was because I was so socially awkward and because I was so anxious that the only way I could get in front of people and get people to pay attention to me that I could do was to get up on stage and screech and jerk around and mm-hmm. play angular guitar and say, look at me.
I think to an extent that's a one-way street where you're up there performing and you're going to get applause, you're going to get praise and that sort of thing, but you don't actually have to interact in a one-on-one situation that could be unnerving. And it's if it's
a contract
to 20,000,
I'm on stage and you stay over there.
There is a distance. And even though there's 20,000 people waiting on your word and waiting on your instrument, you have the distance. So I see that as a great shield for him. And once again, I don't know anything about the guy. He sounds like an interesting dude. Probably not somebody I'll ever get to run into on the street and pick his brain, though.
There's one more connective element that I might get into if you guys want to.
Please.
Sure.
Bernie Worrell. Obviously, he is a big element of Talking Heads in that sort of early 80s period. And okay. I know he was always, Liz was always familiar with him, probably a big fan of Parliament Funkadelic. But, you know, again, their creative efforts overlap later in their career.
Okay. I did not know that Bernie had a part in this. So edify me.
Played a few tracks here and there on some of their albums. Not a big influence on their studio presence, I would say, but touring, huge influence. And I mean, again, you're going to love this. On their album, Remain in Light, on the seminal 1980s Talking Heads album, Remain in Light, because there was so many layers and so many parts, they had just gone completely wild in the studio, gone completely bonkers. And then all of a sudden they were like, well, let's go on tour. And they were like, oh, that's going to be interesting because we need like eight people to play all this music. And they were like, well, let's get eight people. So Adrian Belew joins as a touring member. Buster Jones joins on bass. Dolet McDonald joins as a backing vocalist. And Bernie Worrell joins as a primary keyboard player.
Okay.
I guess Jerry was always playing two roles. Jerry Harrison was always playing guitar or keyboard, mm-hmm. or just flicking the strings, whatever was needed. And then Bernie comes on board as a second keyboard, or, you know, he doesn't do anything else really, but he plays keyboards on all of their songs. So you get these really interesting live versions of songs that are very different to the studio versions, okay. because Bernie Worrell is putting his woo twist on it, right? And putting his own little spin on it. It's absolutely delightful.
Okay, so you hear Bernie being Bernie. He doesn't change himself just because David Byrne got
well, look, yeah, I mean, David Byrne, I'm sure at that time was could tell anybody to do anything, and if they didn't do it, it was trouble. Uh-huh. But I think that he understood that Bernie was the man, and whatever he wanted to do, you just got to let him go and let him do it. I mean, most people, here's one for you, Josh. Most people are probably familiar with that song, Burning Down the House, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes. Oh, we've got someone.
I know that one.
So Burning Down the House. Burn Down the House was a chant at a Parliament Funkadelic show. If you really wanted them to escalate things, it was like the equivalent of Primus Sucks, I suppose. Okay. Burn down the house. Burn down the house. So they were jamming on what became Burning Down the House. And Chris was shouting, burn down the house. And that just planted a seed in David Byrne's head. I'm not saying that Chris deserves all of the credit, but I think it stuck with David Byrne, and he expanded on that idea in lots of really, really interesting ways. But it shows that their appreciation for Parliament Funkadelic. And then when they needed a player, Bernie Worrell, it was like, well, who else would you get? If you can get Bernie, you get Bernie.
Yeah. I thought when you started telling the anecdote that they needed 8 people, so they just got Bernie. Because he could do that. Well, that's another great connection I was unaware of. That's fantastic.
Yes, and I think there's also a lot of that with Les Claypool, because when it comes to Les, you know, he brings out the best in the musicians that he's working with, and he pushes them beyond their limitations, right, to see how far they can go musically. But out of all the collaborators that he has worked with, I can think of only 2 people that kind of intimidated him in a way, you know, that not that they made him feel small on stage, but in a way that you could tell that he respected them too much to tell them what to do. And those 2 people for me are Stuart Copeland and Bernie Worrell. Proof of that is how during the Bucket of Bernie Brains tour, Les would let Bernie go wild for between 10 to 15 minutes prior to the band coming on stage to do the first song.
I didn't know that. Well, it's just a warm-up for him. He's probably just sitting backstage, you know, doing incredible things with his keys. And it's like, well, hey, why don't you just get out there and like add some extra value to the show, right?
Yeah, right.
And someone please record it. Someone please record it.
So Bernie, how long was Bernie hanging out with Talking Heads? A couple of tours? A couple of records?
He joins in 1980 as a touring member. He adds a little bit on their 1983 album, which is Speaking in Tongues. And then they stopped touring early 1980. Okay. One of their last shows was in my hometown of Melbourne, so I missed out on the chance of seeing them as a full touring act live just because I was 4 years old. My silly parents didn't let me go and see a show when I was 4 years old for a band they didn't even know that I liked 20 years later. Thanks, Dad, for making me so bitter that I get obsessive about Talking Heads and Primus in later years.
Well, what a connection with Byrne and Ballou and Worrell. These are all familiar names to Primus fans, or at least the Primus fans that want to dig a little deeper and find out more about those influences and expand their musical horizons, which, and I always read these articles and I always think I'm falling into this trap of the older I get, the more narrow my scope becomes. And I, you know, I still have my physical music I'm pointing in the general direction of where all my CDs are. And there's a bunch of those I haven't listened to in years. And I'm looking at them thinking, I got to listen to these guys again, because I just keep kind of putting on these blinders or narrowing the focus. And so this is going to help me push out a little bit more.
I'm sure Frankie would agree, but if you wanted a basic foothold into all of the best of what we've just been kind of unpacking and talking about, but there's a Talking Heads live show, which is a bootleg of a TV production, but it's called Live in Rome, and it's sort of renowned within Talking Heads fandom spheres as being, it was pro shot. I mean, the quality these days is degraded because it's decades and decades old, and it was never really preserved at the time. It was just made for TV and then forgotten, but it's grown in legendary status as a live recording. So, and it features Adrian Ballou, features Bernie Worrell. It's a really good jumping off point for all these things that we've just touched on just now.
What I find personally very curious is that Primus has ventured to record covers for studio releases, and they have also covered many songs extensively through their live history. But for whatever reason, they have never touched any Talking Heads or David Byrne song.
Good point.
Yeah, I wonder what they could do with that. Or it might be one of those things where the influence is there, but they don't feel they could do anything that was still Primus. They couldn't bring anything that was uniquely them to the song. But there's lots of songs that they've covered, like on the Rhinoplasty album. And I mean, there's plenty of songs that you wouldn't necessarily think would make great Primus covers, but I think they're all perfectly good. I think all their covers are really interesting.
Mm-hmm. He said before that for their ethos, at least, is to cover it straight or to make it their own. And when I hear something Just these snippets, you can tell that Talking Heads have their own identity, and they really don't sound like anybody else, at least anybody else I've listened to. I think it'd be really hard to play it straight covering this band, especially for a band like Primus that really does sound nothing like them for the most part. You know, maybe there just aren't that many options.
Could be. And it's not like they've left their mind entirely. There's been lots of points where Talking Heads and Liz have overlapped over the years. I know there was a festival, and Frankie probably knows, last year, where Jerry Harrison and Adrian Belew, for the 40th anniversary of Remain in Light, decided to get a supporting band together, or an existing band, but they all joined forces to play some of the songs from Remain in Light to celebrate the anniversary. And it was on the same festival lineup that Liz was on, and I couldn't say exactly what incarnation he was playing as, but there's photos backstage of them just, you know, hanging out, Jerry Harrison and Liz Claypool. So they've stayed in the same circles, and obviously Jerry lives now in San Francisco. There's also another, maybe this would be the most obscure connection between the two bands, but we know that there's a strong connection between Primus and the Residents.
Absolutely.
There is it's there if you go looking for it, but there is a weak connection between Talking Heads and the Residents. And the most prominent place where it comes up is there's a documentary about the Residents called Theory of Obscurity.
Uh-huh.
And I'm sure when you do your Residents episode, whoever you talk to will bring that up because it's a good entry point. But Les is interviewed in that, and Jerry Harrison is interviewed.
That's right. Yes. I just watched it a few months ago. That's right. Yep. Jerry's
in it. Les Claypool and his wife caught American Utopia on Broadway.
Oh.
And I'm sure that show must have inspired Les to do some theatrics.
Theatrics, meaning what do you think? Moving around or presenting songs in different ways?
Yeah, because, you know, Primus is a band that has always relied a lot on the visual factor, whether it be the album covers, the music videos, some stage props, but it's a really visual band. And for a period of time, you know, they focused on the music, and maybe they just had some backdrop or some video playing in the back. But from a few years ago until now, I think they have tried to make a statement with their live shows, whether it be performing an album in its entirety or doing something with costumes or doing something that involves storytelling like the Desaturating Seven. I think Primus is also a band capable of attempting great theatrics, and that's pretty much the school of David Byrne. I mean, he's not the guy that is keen on just going out on stage and playing the songs back to back. He's always thinking of how he can come up with an innovative stage live performance year after year.
Yeah, that Live in Rome show that I talked about before was the start of that, I think, and it was shown on TV and people had VHS copies they were probably watching, and I'm sure that was when he became hyper conscious of that. And also he was working with people who were doing dance productions and theater work and so on. So I'm sure he was like, how can we bring all of this into our show to make our show better? Then Stop Making Sense comes out, which is, you know, it's renowned as one of the best concert films ever made for a good reason. Lots of visual elements going on, screens and concert lighting effects, costume changes, just really, really interesting stuff going on throughout the whole show. And then that is something that for a while he had some meat and potatoes live shows where he would just show up with his band, very humble. Let's just play the songs. Thank you very much. And then leave. But in more recent years, he's definitely moving around the stage, getting, you know, using cutting edge technology to make sure that any band member could go anywhere they want. You don't have to sit behind a drum set if you don't want to. The drum set isn't on a riser so that people can actually see you. You could be walking across the front of the stage if you want. So it'll be interesting to see just with Primus or just generally where that goes next musically. If anyone can go anywhere and do anything, what does that mean for the idea of going to see our band? You're not going to be sitting there waiting for the band to go at you like, there's the guitarist, there's the drummer, there's the bass player. I know where I want to stand. I want to be in front of Liz. I want to be in front of Lur. You know, you could just be anywhere and get that element coming in front of you.
I could see a whole lot of people being upset by not knowing whose mic they're in front of too, which would be great.
I was going to say, who do you usually pick? Do you stand in front of Liz or Lur?
I'm always on Lur's side, yeah.
Sure, yeah.
It's scant, but there's still at least a little bit more of a chance I'll actually hear him talking through his mic. You never know.
Great point.
I was also thinking, Rodney, that in the Primus fan base, we're always clamoring for our favorite songs from the back catalog. Some of them are incredibly obscure, and sometimes Les Claypool doesn't even remember them. And in the case of David Byrne, I know that there's a particular level of frustration when it comes to his solo work and how he wants to talk about it, And people keep referring back to the Talking Heads, and people keep asking about a Talking Heads reunion. Yeah. And what I discovered is that with these kind of artists, it's not that they refuse to look back. The thing is that they do like looking back, but on their own terms. For example, if we compare Between the Teeth from 1992 with Stop Making Sense, it's David Byrne pretty much doing the same thing. He's going out on stage by himself with an acoustic guitar, and the musicians start joining him on stage one by one. He's building up a show exactly like he was doing with Stop Making Sense. So what do you think, Rodney? Do you think it's possible that when an artist has a catalog so big, you know, like Primus or David Byrne, it's not that they don't want to play those songs. It's just that they want to do it in their own terms. Do you agree?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of feeding into that. And I know that you're probably wanting me to get to, like, why doesn't he play songs from the 94 or the 98 albums? Yeah. We'll circle back to that, I'll promise. But to go through the chronology, we sort of mentioned before Stop Making Sense, which comes out in 1984. It's a concert film, and it tours the world, and the band don't have to do anything. So they're like, hey, this is great. We can just stay at home, and the movie goes on tour, and we don't have to tour anymore. This is after many, many, many years of really solid touring. So I'm sure we're a bit burnt out as well. But then you sort of skip forward to their last studio album, 1988's Naked. And 1 year later, David Byrne releases what you would call probably his first proper solo album. And all of a sudden, he wants to tour. And the rest of the Talking Heads are like, hey, we thought you didn't want to tour. And it turned out, unfortunately, what he meant was he didn't want to tour with them.
Yeah.
So he goes out on a tour, and it's all Latin. It's a full Latin band. They all wear the white suits. It's kind of like in the Blues Brothers when Keb Calloway starts playing and the band just changes. All of a sudden, they're all in white suits. You know, it's like that moment, except for Talking Heads. And David Byrne comes out and plays all of his Latin songs and maybe like one Talking Heads song. And people watching are like, okay, oh, I missed the chucking and the bouncing. Can you play Psycho Killer? He's like, no. So then after a couple of years of trying to get that to be a thing, and I would have to say probably with not much success, it seems like he keeps putting out a couple more solo albums, and someone says, you know, the mythical story, the apocryphal story is that someone said to him, no one will take you seriously as a solo artist as long as Talking Heads are a thing. So like, you know, this is, I don't think this actually happened, but this is the story. The next day he runs out to the newspaper and says, Talking Heads are breaking up. So that's, damn. Take that with a grain of salt. I don't know. That's just what I've heard.
Eyes get that wide before.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Maybe he and I need to have a whole other conversation about some stuff. But I think you're right into saying the Between the Teeth show is a bit of an effort from David, I think, to be like, remember me, I'm the Talking Heads guy.
We never hear, hey, I'm Les Claypool, the Primus guy. but I am hearing parallels, and I'm curious what you guys think about this, that it sounds like David Byrne is just driven to create. And we know that Les has said that before. He says, I got to get this stuff out. It's in my head. I want to play it. I'm going to play it with these people. I'll play it with whoever wants to play with me. And it just seems like these people with that kind of personality sometimes tend to find each other or find inspiration in each other. So I see these parallel tracks for these two guys. For the most part, they're very different, but they just both seem so driven to continue to create and find those wrinkles and find new things.
No, absolutely. David Byrne's someone that likes a deadline, and he likes a box that he can work within. He likes a constraint. If the constraint might be, you will sit down for a week, and at the end of that week, you will have written and recorded a full album. Mm-hmm. He might say, well, you know, what if I make that 3 months instead of 1 week? Then I'll make a better album. But it's still a constraint. Having a constraint to work within helps keep him, I think, a bit more focused. I guess maybe with Les, he might say, well, I'm just doing crazy stuff all the time. So sometimes we'll record it. Sometimes it'll be an album. Yeah. Sometimes it's a live show. Sometimes it's some different people that I just want to play live with. Mm-hmm. But there's always something to put out. There's always some creative wheel turning. And it's just about turning that into something that you can share with people or promote.
Structure's important as long as it's their structure. That's my favorite thing.
It's got to be their structure.
Yep. That's my favorite thing. I love it when people have control issues. You just push them. These insights have been quite fascinating for me, and I'm really interested in looking into more Talking Heads, David Byrne stuff. I think you guys have turned me on that path. Thanks.
We're always ready with recommendations.
Number one, remain in light.
I know that one.
Yes, that's pretty much it. That's the start and the stop of the list.
Well, that's I think that's important. Yeah, that's important for people who haven't heard these guys much like me or haven't heard much.
No, I think like Primus, Talking Heads went through various phases where they were exploring different things. They obviously go through a phase two where they go from writing, here's a song and it's 3 minutes long to expanding it out to 7-8 minutes. And I know Primus did that later in their career too. Maybe not to 7 minutes. Maybe they started at 7 minutes and dragged it out to 15 or 20 minutes. But they were going for a bit of a different, it's still a jam band vibe, but it's taking it to a different extreme. But I think there's a parallel between that as well. Definitely exploring different phases. There's no question Primus and all of Les's solo efforts. They've always been like a few years where I'm just doing this thing.
Forget the Talking Heads. Let's talk Primus. What the hell were we right. doing all this time? Rodney, I'm curious about your Primus experiences and how that band speaks to you.
They're huge. They're a huge part of my life, huge influence in my appreciation of music, and opened doors to lots of other things. And it's interesting to think about it now, because I go back to high school and I was hanging out with cool creative people who played instruments, and you know, they had jobs on the weekends so they could afford records. And I was living a very like in a suburban bubble. So they were my way out of that. But Primus was one of the first bands that I got into that was really not meat and potatoes, pedestrian, straight down the line. And I got into Talking Heads after them. So I wonder if there's something to that. I wonder if there's something to that, to Primus opening that door to them for me, but then also the Residents. And it's funny how I would say the Residents and Primus and Talking Heads are quite different, but Primus was my gateway to all of that.
Oh, okay. So you went from Primus to these other bands that obviously had an influence on them. So you were working backwards to a degree.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to put it.
Yeah. And I would say I had a similar path, because when I think of Zappa, Residents, and all these other bands, it all came from hearing a Primus record and going, what is this? This is my new favorite thing in the world. Where did this come from?
Well, I think part of it is that it opens you up to new things. It opens you up to more experimentation. So then when you discover more experimentation, you're sort of primed for it, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And I'm really looking forward to experimenting with the Talking Heads and lots of acid. So I think it's going to be a great great experience.
Fantastic.
Rodney, how was your experience catching Primus live over there in Australia?
It was very, very good. So they had toured when I was sort of more of a teenager, didn't have enough disposable income to go and see them. And, you know, just had a lot of things going on where I couldn't catch them. And they would also mostly come out for festivals. So I didn't necessarily want to go and pay festival prices just to watch Primus play a 35-minute set. That wasn't particularly attracting, even though that was all that was on the table. So then when they did come out in the sort of early 2010s, they did play a sideshow, and I was very keen to catch that. I remember it being very good. I remember them playing lots of songs that I wanted to hear. They definitely pulled out the double bass and played the intro from Seas of Cheese, and they played Mr. Crinkle. And I heard a story recently from someone on a podcast where they were like, I saw Primus play at a festival and it sucked. And I was looking to the side of the stage and I could see the double bass wanting them to bring it on, and they never did. And I was so disappointed. And I was like, well, see, that's why you go and see the sideshows, not the festival shows.
I'm glad you got to catch them where they were headlining and not on a festival, because it's a totally different experience. And as it is for, I'm sure, any band. And it's a shame they don't get down there often enough for you, man. It's a long way to come. Yeah. I'll talk to Soya.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it. And I'll have VIP backstage passes too. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Rodney. It was really great to talk to you. Thank you for dropping some knowledge on us. Once again, I mean, you made Frankie's eyes flare. So I know he's going to have questions once we hit stop. But I really appreciate you helping us get into some Primus DNA with Talking Heads and David Byrne. And I'm really looking forward to having all these conversations about all these other bands and acts that contributed to the Primus ethos. But first, I'm going to go listen to Remain in Light in its entirety. Then I'm going to listen to Live in Rome. Then I'm going to watch American Utopia.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's been a real pleasure. And I'm sure Frankie and I will continue Talking Heads conversations. But if anyone wants to hit me up with anything, you know how to find me. And I'm happy to talk Talking Heads all day long.
There it is. The podcast is This Must Be Talking Heads. The Instagram handle is at This Must Be Talking Heads. ThisMustBeTalkingHeads.com, right?
You've got it. And then my Twitter and my email are different. But look, go to the website first and then jump off from there.
I actually want to know how many people make their way towards you, Rodney. So I will exhort everyone to tell Rodney that Primus Tracks sent you.
Perfect. I would love to hear it.
Later days.
Willie Mays. All on the punches.